Folks, welcome to Socrates in the Studio. This is the studio. Today, we have kind of an interesting Socrates in the Studio session because it's with someone with whom I've had many conversations, but never in a Socrates format. That person is this man, John Smirak. John Smirak, welcome to Socrates in the Studio.
Thank you, Eric. I really appreciate it. And I like the fact that it's being videotaped. It's not live, so you can...
It's not live.
You can edit things out. I don't
so
need to
we
wear
can
that
shock... curse like Red Fox.
I don't have to wear that shock collar.
Right.
Yeah.
We've known each other for since college, and I've interviewed you many, many times, but this... is different. This is Socrates in the City. It's a different brand. It's a different thing. And you have come out. You do a lot of writing, but today you come here as the author of what I know to be an important book on a very important subject. In the interest of full disclosure, I wrote the foreword to the book because it seems to me such an important subject. So first of all, congratulations on this important book.
Thank you, Eric.
It is titled No Second Amendment, No First. So let's start with the nutshell version of the subject of the book before I start saying what it is. Tell me in your own words, what is the thesis of the book?
The thesis of the book is that religious liberty and gun rights in America are not just two accidental byproducts of our history. They're not quirks of the founding or stuff that happens to be in the Constitution. They both flow out of the same worldview, the same view of the human person as the image and likeness of God within inalienable dignity, inalienable rights, an eternal destiny, and profound responsibilities before God and to our neighbor.
How did you come to write this book? And again, I mentioned the title, No Second Amendment, No First. That's not necessarily something that's clear to people, which is why I am so happy you wrote the book and you give the intellectual background. But how did you come... let's put it another way. You have written and thought about these things a lot over a long time. But to write a significant, to some extent, scholarly treatment of the subject, because people talk about these things a lot. But what led you to say this needed to be done?
Watching what happened during the COVID panic, watching people... throw away their constitutional rights and their human dignity with both hands in a desperate quest to feel safe. Watching pastors shut down their churches, bishops shut down their cathedrals, the Pope turn his moral theology over to the World Health Organization, watching even President Trump be at first beguiled by Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx, watching... YouTube say that it would censor doctors and researchers from speaking what they believed about the experimental gene therapy they called a vaccine. Watching pro-lifers of many years just willingly throw over their scruples about an abortion-tainted vaccine. I want to be clear, the vaccines that were offered in the United States and around the world, there was no pro-life alternative. All the vaccines were developed using a kidney taken from an aborted girl named Johanna, who was aborted in the Netherlands, I believe, in 1967. Her kidney was taken out while she was still alive, because that's the only way you can get usable organs, is to vivisect a living fetus. They took out her kidney and they cloned it. H-E-K some number, but I call her Johanna because she deserves a name. And the Dutch researcher who developed this cell line testified under oath before the FDA, before Congress, that it was an abortion. And we know medically there's no way to get an organ unless the child is still living when it's extracted. So this was a really gruesome and horrible thing. It's as if the vaccine were made from Anne Frank's body when she was murdered in the death camp. And I said, I'm not taking this vaccine. Maybe I'll die from it because I'm overweight. I'm in the risk factor. I'd rather die than live from the fruits of an abortion. Watching the Pope and prominent pastors, including some conservative pastors whom you've spoken before, watching them all say, oh, no, there's no moral problem here. You've got to get the vaccine. It's your duty. If you love your neighbor, you'll get the vaccine. Watching that, I thought, wow, they sold out cheap. They didn't even get 30 pieces of silver. They got 3. And you know what? It turned out to be little chocolate candies wrapped in foil.
I didn't think we'd leap into to discussion of the vaccine, but I'm glad we did, because what amazes me, John, about you, one of the reasons I admire you, is that you discover things and write about them that no one else has discovered or written about. So we're going to be talking about the Second Amendment and gun rights, but I was myself, and this is not the first time, astonished when you presented this information to me on my radio program. I thought, this is what always happens to me. I hear something like this, and then I think, why haven't I heard this before? This is very important information. This is not your opinion.
Is John just a nut? And yeah, believe me, I wish I were.
Well, you are a nut. But even though you're a nut, you're 100% right on all of these things. And when this information is presented, I think it's hard for people generally, myself included, to process it, because you say, surely I would have heard of this. This is too important for it not to have been covered. So your statement, which I just want to be clear before we move on, is that every one of the vaccines that were being pushed was tainted as being derived from an aborted human being.
Right.
Okay. So that's one level of horror.
And the fact that the churches fell all over themselves the moment Big Brother snapped his fingers. Oh, we'll close our churches. We'll get checks from the government. What could be better? We don't even have to show up on Sunday. We don't have to do anything. Like, oh, wow, the churches just want to be part of the government the way they are in Germany. They just want to have salaries from the government. They don't really want to be independent civic institutions that could potentially push back against tyranny, which, by the way, is what's happening. Gretchen Whitmer shut down her state and locked all the citizens in their homes in violation of the state constitution, as the state Supreme Court later said. She suffered no consequences. You know who did? People who the FBI lured into a fake plot to kidnap her, whom they entrapped the way they routinely entrapped Muslim Americans after 9/11. That Patriot Act, which I condemned at the time, when George W. Bush promoted it, I said, don't give George W. Bush any powers you don't want Hillary Clinton to have in 4 years. Nobody listened to me. And the Patriot Act was weaponized by Barack Obama to turn the FBI into a secret police that serves the political interests of whoever's in power.
I just want to go back to the beginning. Ultimately, your book, the principal thesis of the book is that our Second Amendment rights
flow from the same vision of the human person as our First Amendment rights. And people who are willing to surrender our Second Amendment rights don't care about our First Amendment rights.
Okay.
The same churches who, when there's a mass shooting, they come out and they talk about the epidemic of gun violence as if it were tuberculosis or something. They don't talk about this person committed a terrible sin and murdered these people. His soul is accountable before God. Their souls have gone to God. Let's pray for the dead. Let's pray for the survivors. Let's pray for the conversion of this disgusting murderer. No, they talk about the bacillus of gun violence is spreading to every community and we must vaccinate ourselves against it. They talk as if we are not human beings with immortal souls, as if we were termites in a colony and they work for the queen. And we are all meant to follow, to like sniff around till we get the pheromone or watch the other termites, bees dancing around in order that we can just operate like little robots. And nothing made them happier than to do this. The glee with which people said, oh, I got vaccinated. Oh, I'm wearing a mask. Oh, I'm staying home.
Well, okay, so there's some... I want to go back again to another thing. So how was it that this abrogation of rights and freedoms led you to write this book? In other words, as we experience these things unprecedented in America, we had never seen these kinds of things. And I think this is why so many people, to give them a little grace, the reason they went along is because of the unprecedented nature. We had not been trained to be wary of these kinds of things. So tons of people whom we might otherwise respect and expect to do the right thing were caught unawares and went along with it. And we now see what happened.
We now see just how dangerous it is to trust the people in authority. If you hear someone is associated with an international organization, you should and you talk to such a person, you should count the fillings in your teeth afterwards and see if your credit cards are still in your wallet.
Right. Well, some people learned that in the last few years. Many didn't, but some did. Because freedom is something that I always say we pretty much take for granted because we've had it. It's been challenged so little in America.
All right, but look what happened in 2020. Political riots stirred up by the Democratic Party using the pretext of George Floyd. Remember, the cops who killed George Floyd were immediately suspended, arrested, prosecuted, convicted, and imprisoned. The system worked. But the people wanted to destroy the system, the anti-American Marxists like Barack Obama and his ghostwriter Bill Ayers, who was a Weather Underground terrorist, like Kamala Harris, who was trained by Willie Brown, the good friend of Jim Jones, the cult leader, the radical left that is anti-American, that says that the American founding itself was a conspiracy of slave owners in 1619. I call the 1619 Project the Protocols of the Elders of Jamestown, because it is every bit as unhinged a conspiracy theory as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Both of them were political conspiracy theories cooked up by journalists and promoted in newspapers in order to demonize and target members of a different ethnic group so that the government could persecute them. Well, you remember the George Floyd riots, people hiding in their homes, leftist mobs taking control of entire neighborhoods in places like Seattle and Portland. Beating up their political enemies. Store owners like Jake Gardner, a bar owner in Omaha, Nebraska, tried to defend his elderly father from a looter. He was prosecuted and for allegedly committing a racial hate crime by shooting the looter who was choking him. He was driven to suicide. He was a U.S. combat hero. And after his suicide, a Democratic member of the Omaha legislature went on Twitter to gloat about his death.
You dedicate this book
to Jake Gardner. I'm in touch with his family. And when the book is printed, I'm going to take the first copy and I'm going to go to Arlington National Cemetery to Jake Gardner's grave, and I'm going to lay it on Jake Gardner's grave. And I want everyone watching this to remember Jake Gardner, to pray for him and his family. He was a victim of the American deep state, a victim of the tyranny that the left and the compliant, wussy, cowardly churches are imposing upon us one step at a time. But in 2020, you had people locked in their homes with their jobs canceled, their churches closed because of this virus. But you could have George Floyd riots, and those were fine. Those did not spread the virus because racism is a public health threat. And so by being anti-racist, they're actually healthy. But if you go to a Trump rally, that's a super spreader event. Do you remember Herman Cain, that wonderful businessman who had run for president? He went to a Trump rally. He caught COVID. He died. They mocked him on television. They laughed about it. Oh, that's what happens when you go to these super spreader events. At the same time, rioters were looting stores all across the country, and they were being described as mostly peaceful.
Can we go back to John Locke? for those who are unaware of John Locke, tell those watching, who was John Locke?
John Locke was a devout Protestant in England under the Stuarts. And the Stuarts were sort of high Anglicans sympathetic to Catholics. And there was a civil war in England between basically the Puritans on the one side and the Anglicans and Catholics on the other. And each side persecuted the other. Nobody comes out of this with clean hands. But out of that struggle, they finally established a constitutional monarchy when they brought in William and Mary. And this is the origin of our Second Amendment and its connection to religious freedom. The text of our Second Amendment is lifted almost word for word, from the English Bill of Rights of 1690. But here's the interesting difference. In the English Bill of Rights, it says no Protestant may be deprived of the right to have firearms. And I said, my first instinct as a Catholic was to be offended by that. And then being half Irish, I could sort of see the sense of it, but just thinking of my family. But I used to joke that everyone in America should be allowed to have a gun except Smirax. But since then, I've moved to Texas, and I'm now very good with an AR-15. I still won't drive a car, though. I live in Dallas, but I will not drive. I have an AR-15, but I will not drive. There are certain principles I will not compromise, and I'm going to Uber it for the rest of my life. But anyway, Protestants can't be deprived of weapons. Why would it be so weirdly specific? So then you read the history. Charles I, Charles II, James II had been disarming Puritans, had been searching their churches and taking away their weapons in order to render them helpless for a civil war or a persecution. So as a condition of accepting the throne, King William and Queen Mary had to sign this Bill of Rights, which guaranteed Protestants the right to have guns. So why were the Protestants so keen on having guns? It wasn't to defend their store of goods from Amway. It wasn't to hunt ducks. It was to protect their religious freedom. The same kind of people created the colonies in North America, most of them. And their churches were where they had militias. You would go to church, you would hear a sermon on the importance of defending your community, and then you would go out and do target practice, and you would drill in order to defend your church and your town from the Indians or the Spanish or the French. Those were the people who then defended their cities and towns from the English and overthrew that government and established the United States of America. And that's why they wrote the Second Amendment into the Constitution. Stephen Halbrook, a wonderful constitutional scholar, has got a number of books. One is called The Founder's Second Amendment. And what he shows you the debates about the Second Amendment among the founders. Nobody debated whether Americans had the right to have guns. The whole point of America was militias that would defend their freedom against tyranny. And the whole Constitution was written, it's like a Rube Goldberg designed to make government as frustrating and difficult as possible, to make it impossible for a tyrant to take power. It's this huge, elaborate Rube Goldberg. Foreigners looked at it, especially the French, and they said, this is not efficient. How can the king do anything? That's the whole point. We don't want a Napoleon. We don't want a Robespierre.
Gridlock was the point.
Gridlock was the point.
Matt
Gaetz was the point. That someone like Matt Gaetz could come along and speak truth to power and try to defund the FBI from kicking down the doors of pro-lifers and infiltrating Latin Mass Catholic churches and persecuting PTA moms who don't want child porn dumped on their kids. The whole point of the Constitution was so that Matt Gaetz could bring Kevin McCarthy down and could defund Jack Smith and defund the deep state. That's why we have a United States of America. That's why we're not just a bunch of provinces like Canada.
Are you still the same? Don't you realize the things we did?
All the founders agreed that gun rights were crucial. James Madison said, if all these checks and balances I have written into this Constitution fail, you will still have a militia of millions that would overthrow any tyrant. So the Second Amendment was
Madison said that.
He said that.
That we'd still have a militia of millions to overthrow any tyrant.
And so that the Second Amendment is the break glass in case of tyranny hanging on the wall in the founding of the United States. So isn't it interesting that the connection was between religious freedom and gun rights? That seems to suggest it comes from something profound, right?
Yeah.
That there's something basic about the human person that says he should be able to worship in the way his conscience directs him without secret police from the government coming and saying, oh, no, no, in this county you have to be a Mennonite, or in this county you have to be a Catholic. If you want to be a Baptist, you're going to have to go down the road because that's a Baptist county. No, that's not how we're going to do things here, because we saw what a disaster it was in Europe. We saw that having state-sponsored churches produced a lot of lazy bureaucrats who didn't really care about the kingdom of God but wanted to make sure that their check cleared. Well, isn't that what happened with the PPP loans? All our churches became government-supported churches that were dependent on checks from the government. And a lot of our churches, my own Catholic church, are heavily dependent on nonprofit contracts from the federal government to resettle immigrants. I joke that the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops is an immigration pyramid scheme and gay employment agency with a Catholic problem, because 40% of their money comes from federal resettlement money, where what they're doing is they're helping the human traffickers get people from Latin America and resettle them around America and get them on public assistance, and they're creaming off part of the money.
Okay, so this we got a lot of things in the middle here. So number one is the idea that our founders realized that churches need to be part of the free market.
Right.
They need to afford.
They can't be like American automakers in the 70s that are protected by tariffs, so they create rolling couches. They get 5 miles per gallon.
Well, I don't remember those, but
Pontiac Bonneville.
Yeah. Actually, I love the Pontiac
Bonneville. So do I.
That was awesome car.
It was a rolling couch.
But that was one of the greatest cars ever. The tail fins were not that high. It was like just right.
It was my favorite.
My Uncle Joe had a Pontiac Bonneville. But the principle is that we want the government to stay out of our business. We want people to be able to be utterly free to do whatever they want.
Respecting the inalienable rights of their neighbors and
obviously,
the common good.
Right.
Right. Well, we're not libertarian.
Well, exactly. God forbid. But the point is that you're saying that what fascinates me really about this idea is that we've become, even people who talk about the Second Amendment have become generally unmoored from these fundamental foundational ideas. We mention the Second Amendment, the militia, whatever, but we don't seem...
We don't draw the connections.
We don't...
The same people who go to church on Sunday and go to the gun range on Saturday, they might do both things, but they don't see the fundamental, profound connection between those things. That the same vision of the human person that says you should be able to defend yourself against home invaders, not just wait for the police to come and draw a chalk line around your wife's body. You should be able to defend yourself. And by the way, if the police become tyrannical, you should be able to defend yourself against them too. That is the same vision that created the churches, that had the Second Great Awakening, that is the vision of America. So the same reason you go to church on Sunday is the reason you go to the gun range on Saturday, because you're the same person. You're not becoming a different person when you go to a different place. You are the same image of God who has the same fundamental rights and responsibilities. And I saw all these things being thrown aside during the COVID panic, with our churches falling all over themselves to prostitute themselves to Caesar and Mammon and Sodom. So I'm a student of history. My PhD is in literature, it would have been in history, but I'm terrible at foreign languages, and you need too many foreign languages to do history, so I did literature, sorry. But I'm obsessed with history. I view everything that happens in terms of historical precedent. I'm always going, well, that's just like the Byzantine Empire in 700, and my girlfriend goes, oh, would you shut up? What is wrong with you? But that is literally how I see things. Oh, wait, this is like the late Roman Republic, or this reminds me of the Anglo-Saxon resistance to the Normans. So what do we learn from history? Our founders said, if you disarm the populace, they will be subject to tyranny.
Hey, get rhythm. When you get the blues, come on, get rhythm. When you get the blues, get a rock.
Let's look at the history of the 20th century. I co-wrote a book with our friend Jason Jones, The Race to Save Our Century, which we issued in 2014 on the 100th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, warning about the violence that was coming down the pike with the loss of respect for human rights and dignity. Well, in that research for that book, I came across a scholar named R.J. Rummel. He was a genocide scholar, and his book, his most famous book, is called Death by Government, and you can actually find it online for free. More than 200 million civilians were murdered by their governments on purpose between 1914 and 1990, not including casualties of war. The estimates go between 170 and 250 million. Imagine, let's just say, pick the middle estimate, 200 million. That's like the population of France and England.
Well, it makes the Holocaust look like a footnote.
Well, the Holocaust is part of that, and the Soviet genocides are part of that. Mao's famines are part of that. But again, this was only like 85 years or 75 years, but 1914 to 1990. What did those 200 million victims of genocide have in common? Because we're talking Tutsis in Rwanda, Cambodians in the killing fields. What did all those people have in common? Wouldn't it be interesting to know what was the unifying characteristic of the victims of genocide? Well, you know, it's actually easy to find. They had one quality in common. They had all been disarmed by their governments first.
Well, part of what I find fascinating about your book, No Second Amendment, No First, is that you remind us, and we've been doing it a little bit, but you remind us of this, on one level, radical idea, and another level, utterly foundational idea in America, that we are... We the people are the government, and we must beware of and protect ourselves against tyranny. It's not something that we abolished one time,
right,
250 years ago, but it's something that always will come back.
It is a fundamental temptation in the fallen human heart. It's like saying, oh, we abolished prostitution back in the 1870s, so, you know, we'd have to worry about that. That'll never happen again.
Right.
Who would ever do such a thing?
Right.
What?
Well, but the thing is, I mean, the reason I put it that way is because it seems to me, and I myself am guilty of this, of drift, where you forget over time that we actually need to take this seriously.
You forget that our ancestors fought and died for these exact privileges, for these exact liberties. Or they came across the ocean to find these liberties because they were being denied them in their home countries.
But, and not just that, but that, I guess my point here is that I feel like most Americans, including gun-toting, pro-Second Amendment Americans, are kind of like the Tories in our revolution. They forgot that it's possible that you might need to use your weapons against your own government. It's like a distant theory, but most of us don't think of that way. I mean, we're filming this in Texas, so maybe I'm thinking about people outside of Texas. But the point is that it is an extraordinary thing. And also, John, because in the years since the revolution. We no longer have, you know, it's one thing to own a musket when the redcoats have muskets. But now we are facing something different. In other words, I can't have a bazooka and a tank in my garage.
I give you another potent example. A book I really recommend highly is Gun Control in the Third Reich by Stephen Halbrook. And he documents how when the Nazis came to power, they didn't even need to pass new gun control laws because the Weimar Republic, good liberals that they were, had put in gun registration.
Yeah.
And, of course, the communists and the Nazis had just ignored it. But all the good people, the Jews and the socialists and the labor union members, they had all registered their guns. So in the build-up to Kristallnacht, the Nazis just collected all the Jews from the guns from the Jews so they couldn't defend their synagogues when they decided to burn them. I'll give you another historical example. One of the nightmares of our age was the genocide of Christians in Iraq that George W. Bush enabled through his pointless, stupid war in Iraq. People like me warned him, this will cause the genocide of Christians. They will blame the local Christians for America's policies, and nobody will protect them. They will be the scapegoats. And W. said, which I did not think was an adequate response. And his soldiers did nothing to protect the local Christians. And three-quarters of them were driven out of the churches and villages where they've lived since the second century. Some of the oldest churches in the world were burned by Muslim militias. And our troops stood by and did nothing because that's what Bush ordered them to do, and later what Obama ordered them to do. The Christians of Iraq, and I know some personally who are now in exile, living in shipping containers. They can't even get into the refugee camps because those are controlled by Muslims. And you have to be a Muslim to get into them. So they can't even go to the UN refugee camps. They're living in shipping containers in the winter. What? These Iraqi Christians were the victims of genocide. There's no other word for it. They were disarmed by the Iraqi government. We said, oh, you need gun control. And the Iraqi government put in gun control, and the Christians didn't have any guns.
This was, you know, this was after during the war, after the war?
During our occupation.
During
the American occupation, we put in gun control laws.
America, I want to be clear. Under George W. Bush, we told the Iraqi government of that time, okay, they weren't Baathists, but they weren't exactly, you know,
Washington and Jefferson and Franklin.
They weren't exactly the founders. They instituted gun control.
And guess who obeyed the law? The Christians. Guess who didn't? The Islamists and the jihadis. So the disarmed Christians were subjected to genocide. A very it's as if there were a divine laboratory experiment here. Go one country over to Syria, where John McCain and the neocons wanted to overthrow the government and create chaos and genocide, but they failed thanks to people like Trump and Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, the only candidates who did not, in 2016, want to risk a nuclear war with Russia, shooting down Russian planes to help bring al-Qaeda to power in Syria. Civil war in Syria. The Christians in Syria have guns. They allied with the Kurds. They fought a war and they defeated ISIS. They liberated the caliphate of ISIS. They're the same people, Syriac-speaking Christians. Neighboring countries, 10 years apart. The ones who let themselves be disarmed by the government, subject to genocide. The ones who formed Christian militias, their churches are spreading. They're making converts. Their churches are growing. You could not have a more perfect laboratory experiment on the effect of gun rights on religious freedom and resistance to genocide than what happened, by contrast, in Iraq and in Syria. And I have a chapter on this in the book.
I was just going to say, I don't remember, it's been so long since I read the book, but you write about this in the book, The title is No Second Amendment, No First. How extraordinary that under George W. Bush, we persuaded the Iraqi government that we had sort of shepherded into existence to institute policies antithetical to our own Constitution.
Well, George Bush was antithetical to our Constitution, so what's the big surprise there? I mean, no, seriously,
I know.
Establishment rhino Republicans are the worst people in the world. They are the controlled opposition. They are the people who pretend to fight for us and sell us out. It was John McCain who brought the fake Russia collusion document to the FBI. As a sitting senator said, this has to be investigated. And that's what created the fake impeachment of Donald Trump, by which our deep state, controlled by Obama's appointees, nullified the results of a Democratic election because the deep state didn't like it.
Now, look, to be clear, this is not about politics.
Right.
This is about foundational principles.
Right.
And so I often have said, it really doesn't matter who you voted for, but you understand the basic rules. We, the people, get to choose our leaders. And when
the CIA doesn't get a veto and the FBI doesn't get a veto.
Well, that's the point. And so when you realize that they're doing that, you have to say, excuse me, that those aren't the rules of the game. John, the reason your book is so important is because we are at a I never want to quote Malcolm Gladwell, so I won't say tipping point. But
crossroad. We're at a crossroad.
Worded in, I would say, an inflection point. We are facing in America, as I see it, the third existential threat of our existence. The first was in the revolution. The second was in the Civil War. We are now facing an existential threat. And so people need to understand, as they did during the revolution, as they did during the Civil War.
And let's clarify this.
This is it, folks. This is it.
Let's clarify the threat. The regime is trying to imprison its political opponent and prosecute dissidents for speaking against the state. The security apparatus has become a politicized secret police. It just classified supporters of Donald Trump, of the political opponent, as potential terrorists. Our leader, Biden, gave a speech demonizing the half the country that voted against him, demonizing them as being like Nazis. Dehumanizing and demonizing rhetoric is being used against Christians, against white people, against conservatives. The term they're using now is we must decolonize. We must decolonize America. What that means is kill whitey.
We are now facing a group of people who tend to be on the left, but with tons of complicity from useless people on the right, who all of whose values are antithetical to our fundamental principles as Americans. In other words, what everyone on the left and the right agreed on for most of the last 250 years is now being threatened by people who are participating in things that we have never before seen in America.
Let me illustrate the point. 5 years ago, Bernie Sanders would go to Mount Rushmore and talk about how patriotic socialism is. Now he's on board with all the people who say, oh, this is stolen from the Indians. It should be blown up. We shouldn't have these things. America should never have been founded. Why do you think they tore down statues? I defended all historical statues.
If we really did steal Mount Rushmore from the Indians, I think we should give it back.
Yeah, if they actually carved that themselves, and they have video footage of
that. It's like the Elgin Marbles, you know? We should give it back. The Brits should give it back.
No,
but you're saying that even in 5 years, you've seen, in other words, people
who... Why were they tearing down statues of Christopher Columbus and Abraham Lincoln. They tore down one Frederick Douglass statue, I think, by mistake. I was defending Confederate statues because I was saying we should not be sandblasting our history. If you want, put up a statue of an abolitionist across from the Confederate statue and have plaques explaining it. What these people want is to demonize the past, to stuff it all down the memory hole, to demonize everything that came before them, the way the communists demonized everything that came before the Russian Revolution, the way Hitler demonized everything that happened in Germany since basically the end of the Dark Age. As he said, Christianity, the coming of Christianity to Germany was a mistake. We need to go back. We need to go back before all these historic crimes to like the primeval forest. What does that do? Orwell in 1984 wrote, "He who controls the past controls the future." Because you can tell people what everything means if you have made a blank space out of the past. And I think that's an easy sell with young people because they think it's kind of racist or something for you to force me to study events that happened before the universe winked into existence when I was born. That's kind of racist, isn't it? Racist, by the way, is just the vague, meaningless term for anything you don't like. It used to be fascist, now it's racist. So, like, if a hailstorm damages your car, right, just talk about that, man, this weather is so racist. We need to just use the... We need to help them deflate that word out of any meaning at all because it's now exclusively used as a club to beat up Christians and pro-lifers.
Well, I mean, this gets...
Even black Christians and black pro-lifers get called racist for being Christian and pro-life. So the word has been deflated to the point of meaninglessness.
Well, it's interesting because I think there's a connection here that history, the facts of history give us a common context. In other words, there's rules of the game where, in a sense, we're all equal because we're playing by these rules. When words have certain meaning, we all know the meaning of the words, and we can communicate. What the enemies of freedom want to do is basically
Humpty Dumpty
knock over the chessboard,
right,
and say we're no longer playing chess. There's no winners and losers. We are going to decide what the rules are. Right. We don't want a level playing field because we might lose.
Right.
We don't want anyone to know what the rules are or what the history is because we might lose. So we have to wipe out the past. We have to wipe out history. We have to destroy the meaning of words. There's something just profoundly nihilistic about this, which makes it a grab for power.
One more historical analogy that I think is important. You ever wonder why the Democrats act so much like Nazis all the time?
I don't, but please tell me what you think about that.
Well, for instance, when Barack Obama was elected president, you and I weren't happy, but we didn't demonize half the country that supported him. We didn't say that he had cooperated with a foreign dictator to steal the election. We didn't try to imprison his political opponents. We didn't try to have him impeached based on fake charges. We didn't try to imprison his supporters. We regarded it as a legitimate election where we had a really bad candidate.
Right, well, because we believe in the rules. We believe in the rule of law. We believe that we, the people, get to pick our leaders. And if we, the people, chose Barack Obama, he is the president of the United States.
But in 2016...
Right.
In 2016... when we, the people, narrowly chose Donald Trump, the left were absolutely flabbergasted. They were so sure that Obama had fundamentally transformed America, that he had been like the first leader in a colony after the British left, a post-colonial strongman, president for life. They thought everything changed with Barack Obama. If you remember the religious hysteria that guilt-ridden white liberals would greet his appearance, it was like the scene in Jesus Christ Superstar. They would sing, Obama, 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 Obama. It was a religious event. They were washed in the flop sweat. They were purified. They had been lost, but now they were found. It was a religious experience of the most pathetic and contemptible type. Ludicrous. Out of... pathetic, but... it was really meaningful for a lot of people. The idea that Donald Trump could then be elected, that was okay, a fundamental
so
betrayal.
To clarify, when you say, at least somewhat hyperbolically, that why do Democrats act like Nazis, the point is,
that they,
until that point, they did not. In other words, the Democratic Party,
right. Basically,
until very, very recently...
followed the rules.
Right would have thought of them as the principled opposition. We have many things in common. We can debate.
Right.
We can differ on tax rates. We can differ
right.
on certain things. How much legislation is good? Something changed
in 2016 when the people elected Donald Trump. The Democrats felt like they had been stabbed in the back. The way the Germans did in 1918 when they lost World War I. They were sure they were going to win World War I. They were sure of it. The Russians had collapsed. They were going to rule Europe. And then suddenly they lost the war. People like Hitler, but that millions of others, decided this can't be right. We didn't lose fair and square. There was foreign collusion. We were betrayed by extremists in our midst, by foreigners and aliens who are conspiring against us because they believe in evil, wicked, extreme ideas. And they created the whole stab-in-the-back myth that then they used to scapegoat Jews and socialists and liberals and Catholics and men like Dietrich Bonhoeffer. That whole stab-in-the-back myth was the result of a hysterical reaction on the part of nationalistic Germans to losing World War I. The left in America had the same reaction to losing the 2016 election. It had to be that Vladimir Putin faked the voting machines, or he used Facebook ads and brainwashed people, or Trump colluded with Russia. They kept looking and reaching and grasping for explanations to justify why they had been stabbed in the back. And they demonized everyone against them the same way. They even called themselves the resistance. If you call yourself the resistance, you're saying your opponents are Nazis. They deserve to be, I don't know, killed or arrested.
I mean, again, we have to go back to the time when, I was asked to speak at the 2012 prayer breakfast. The president was Barack Obama. I differed with him, obviously, politically, but I respected the office of the presidency, because I respected the United States Constitution. All of that changed in 2016. When you referred to the resistance, I just remember, when they started saying, not my president, I thought, wait a second. You don't need to like the president, but the beauty is, every 4 years we have an election. We have rules that everyone abides by. You can advocate for a different candidate. That's America.
But
what changed
right.
in 2016.
Well, my book is all about reclaiming the original founding vision of America and the link between the churches and our freedoms and rights and duties as citizens, and how the churches went squishy, how they went corrupt, how they sold out. This is all part of the book. And how you can organize to demand these rights and to resist the new tyranny that is being imposed on us in the name of keeping us all safe, keeping us all neutered, making us all into good little worker ants in the colony.
One of the things about the free market, which, gets way back to the time after Martin Luther, when we're talking about religious liberty, and you were talking about, the idea that in this principality or in this state or whatever. You know, we've all got to be this religion, right? That effectively was as far as religious liberty got, which is not so far, until roughly the establishment of the United States of America.
Right.
Right. And that's a big thing, because now I can go to any church I want. I can go to no church. I can go to a mosque.
You can start a church.
I can start a church. We have total religious liberty in the United States of America, but it didn't exist before the United States of America. Before the United States of America, if you were in Connecticut, you had to be a Congregationalist, or if you had to be whatever. And what that means today, I know there's one of the weapons that we have today is that if you're going to some church that has this wrong-headed view of things and that is marching in lockstep with the cancellation of our freedoms, you can leave. And I always say that to people, that you have an obligation. If you're going to a church that doesn't have this vigorous, healthy, biblical view of things, and you continue to go there, you are complicit.
You could stay and heckle till they drag you out.
Yes, you could. But I guess it's interesting to me, John, because it's one thing for us to criticize church leaders, and they deserve most of the criticism. But it's fascinating because you still have many people in the pews who I hope will read your book now, but they themselves are, in a sense, enabling this broken view of liberty, this broken view of what it means to be a Christian, this hyper Romans 13 view of what it means to comply with the government. I guess they never read the Book of Esther. They never read. You know, they really they're making it possible by supporting a church that is going along with the things that you've described.
A church which tells you to just obey the government even when it's promoting evil is a church that doesn't really believe in the afterlife. It believes that it's here to help us be comfortable and give us a place to gather on Sundays and social opportunities and uplifting thoughts, and we can be sort of Jesus-y, which is kind of nice. You know, I'd rather be Jesus-y than not.
But that's the kind of church, that's the official church in China.
Yeah.
It's this official church in China. You go into that building, you do whatever you want on a Sunday morning, but when you leave that church, you bow to the secular authority of the atheist state.
And it's no accident that Hillary Clinton started talking about freedom of worship, not free exercise of religion, that under Obama, the citizenship test was rewritten to talk about freedom of worship, not free exercise of religion.
Do you know who alerted me to this was the late, great Chuck Colson. I remember him bringing this up. And he was not, you know, some partisan political guy. I remember when he said that, he said freedom of worship is radically different to freedom of religion. Yeah. Freedom of religion means not that you have the freedom to go into that building and do what you like for a few hours on Sunday morning. Freedom of religion is that when you leave that building, you are free, as per the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, to exercise your faith in every sphere beyond that building.
That means running schools that teach that there are men and women.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to talk about that another time. But I want to say that concept of freedom of worship versus freedom. And again, these words are all, you know, words are slippery things. But the problem with freedom of worship is that it's training you to think that the expression of your religious faith is meant to be a merely religious thing in a religious building, as opposed to your whole life.
Freedom of worship is like, it's like your church is a bathhouse. Do what you must do in private. We don't want to hear about it. We don't want to see it. It's disgusting. But you know what? Behind closed doors, what consenting adults do to each other is of no interest to me. But But don't bring that outside the bathhouse. No, the church is supposed to be a lighthouse, not a bathhouse.
I would say that it's kind of like it relegates faith to like the level of a hobby. You do some stuff in your
like
basement.
Some secret perversion you indulge that's technically legal, but we don't want to hear about it.
Well, I think that's unfortunately correct. Is that there are people who are repulsed by religion or by expressions of religion, but they say, but you can do it, just don't let it be expressed in the culture.
Well, you know what's funny?
That's exactly what the founders said should not happen.
Well,
exactly,
you know what else?
That
is also what Islam teaches about Christianity, is that you can be... You can have Christians and Jews as subjugated minorities in a Sharia state, but they can have freedom of worship in a building, but it should be unmarked, no crosses, no bells, no processions. You can't proselytize, you can't evangelize, but we will let you have your building, and what you do in the privacy of your building, your infidel building, we will permit. So it is Sharia. It is a secular Sharia supported by leftists and radical Muslims working together for their common goal of destroying the West and destroying Christianity. And then they'll sort out afterwards who kills whom.
So is this what they call dimitude?
Dimitude is the Jim Crow third-class citizenship that is technically offered to Christians in a Sharia state.
If you change your mind,
take a chance.
I'm the first in line.
Take a chance.
Honey, I'm still free.
This is unfortunately an important subject and an important parallel to draw. So here you have something that the most radical Muslims do to Jews if they're lucky and Christians if they're lucky, is they let you live as a subjugated second class citizen in their state, as though this is some kind of generous thing that they're not killing you. In China, if you want to be a Christian, they let you live as a second-class citizen. You go into that building, you do your thing, but when you come out, you know, you offer your pinch of incense to Caesar or Satan. And in America, and you talked about it in the beginning, many Christians voluntarily adopted this view of their faith. They weren't forced to by our government, because we have a constitution that very specifically, explicitly says, no, that's not our view. But they did it voluntarily. It was this mission drift over the decades.
It's less work. It's a lot easier. And it doesn't require you to face hard questions and make sacrifices. Also, the churches kind of began to give up on the idea that they teach what is true about the universe. Starting with the discovery of the age of the earth, the 19th century, and then with the publication of Darwin, more and more churches began to say, well, okay, so the Bible doesn't really tell us what actually happened. It doesn't have any historical value. It doesn't have any scientific value. It's a book of uplifting principles for how we can, gosh darn it, be really good kind of people and just shiny, happy people. I think that's the term. Friedrich Schleiermacher coined the term shiny, happy people.
You're kidding.
Yes.
No.
Yes, I'm making that up.
It was Ned Flanders. But Schleiermacher...
Ned Flanders or Andy Stanley. They look exactly the
same. Okay, or Schleiermacher, the 19th century German version.
Right, but Schleiermacher said... Christianity doesn't offer any scientific or historical knowledge, but it offers us knowledge of what we should aspire to and how we can be good people. There's a wonderful book, The Heart and Soul of the American University by George Marsden, and he shows how America's elite Protestant colleges like Harvard and Yale and Princeton all adopted Schleiermacher. That was their model, so that by the 1930s, the Christian ministries like Dwight Hall at places like Yale were basically glorified soup kitchens.
Right.
The YMCA used to be a Christian mission organization, not a village people song.
Right.
Hard to believe.
Well, it's funny, John, because all of this is touching on the book that I've got coming out in a few months, where I write about this, that something happened, obviously, because of German higher criticism and folks like Schleiermacher. And Bonhoeffer was confronting it directly in his day. So in 1930, the German church had adopted this bastardized, dramatically circumscribed version of the faith that said whatever is specifically theological, or we'll talk about those things, but anything beyond that, we're going to keep it in the basement. It's a hobby. It doesn't exist in the real world. I'm a train conductor down in my basement with my HO scale train set, but in the real world, I'm not. I'm not a real train conductor. I just have a job in corporate America. Basically, that view of Christianity had happened to Germany, which was what allowed the Nazis to take over Germany. And of course, in America, that view, it took us longer to get here, but that view trickled down through mainstream Protestant Christianity.
And then among my own Catholic church, they were so desperate to be mistaken for Episcopalians, to arrive in America and, you know, be upper class, that we explicitly started imitating post-Christian mainline Protestant churches. There's one last thing I want to suggest to you. There's a book called Politicizing the Bible. I was the editor of it, by Scott Hahn and Ben Wicker. And he goes into the roots of the higher biblical criticism. And he shows that from the beginning, biblical criticism started with Hobbes and Machiavelli. The principles of biblical criticism started with Hobbes and Machiavelli. And the whole point of biblical criticism was to take power from the church and give it to the state, and to use these techniques of understanding the Bible to peel away one privilege after another from the church and hand it over to the state to empower Caesar. This was the whole point of it. So it's not a surprise or a shock or a betrayal for it to end up creating the Reich Church in Hitler's control. That was the whole point of biblical criticism over the course of 500 years. I highly recommend that book.
Wow. Okay. We just have a few moments left. I want to say just how excited I am that you wrote this book, John, because this subject needed the kind of treatment you give it. Do you have an answer to why this vital subject has not gotten the treatment that you give it until now, until this book? Because it's a little bit surprising to me that that's the case.
People sort of took this whole complex of ideas for granted. Like, everyone knows that the Constitution emerged from the Christian view of the human person with some Enlightenment tweaks. And the Christian view of the human person implies all these freedoms and all these rights. And these things weren't under such fundamental threat as they have been in the last 5 to 10 years. The Democrats and the left have decided there are no rules. We're in a boxing ring. We're following the Marquess of Queensbury rules, and they take out a chainsaw and they take out a flamethrower. Well, do we keep following the Marquess of Queensbury rules? That's what the establishment Republicans say. Oh, yeah, we're going to win on points. The judges will award it to us on points, and then the flamethrower, and then the chainsaw. No,
that's a direct Mike Pence quote. You need to give attribution.
I know. There was an invisible footnote.
Do you mention the Black Robe Regiment in the book?
No. What's the Black Robe Regiment?
See, now that's amazing. That's the beauty of John Smirak, is that every once in a while he'll miss something, but it just proves what is otherwise impossible to believe, that you're human.
Even Homer Simpson nods.
It's Well, it's just because, no, but what's so fascinating to me is that everything you're writing about could be summed up, in a sense, by the Black Robe Regiment, which is to say those revolutionary era ministers and pastors who
fought,
who not only fought, but exhorted their congregations. In other words, they understood what you write about in this book innately because they were all, you know, Lockeans. They were all, they all of this stuff was fresh 250 years ago.
Right.
And now we need to be reminded. But so anybody, and there will be many in the audience familiar with the Black Robe Regiment, need to read this book because we need to understand where the Black Robe Regiment got their ideas from. And, of course, you do cover that in the book.
I even go through the history of Christian thinking about our right to rebel against tyrannical governments and how and where the conviction that we had the right to overthrow tyrants, how that emerged in
right.
the Christian world. And interestingly, it came from, on the one hand, Calvinists, and on the other hand, Jesuits, both of whom elaborated theories on how and why you could overthrow a government that was persecuting your religion or taking your other fundamental human rights. So it's a fascinating narrative in the course of this intellectual book.
Well, the book is worth the price of the price you pay just for my foreword.
That's right.
My foreword is that good. And I want to say, John, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for all that you do. And thank you specifically for being my guest today at Socrates in the studio.
Thank you. And if people want to read my writing, I write four times a week at stream.org, one of the best ecumenical Christian conservative news sites out there, stream.org.
I agree heartily. Thank you.
Thank you.